Mr. Routledge, Rule 4. So, you got to the Lonkin Jade Mines.
Yes.
Where else did you get to on this trek?
Well, we more or less found that the Japanese had been and gone, and we moved on again, you see, and carried on. I think they were carrying on then towards Imphal and Kohima. So were all the other columns in Burma. They were all converging on more or less one place at a time, you see. In our part of the Burma they were, you know, there was our sister column. There was other columns coming in. There was a border regiment column coming in, I think, at one time. And they were converging on Imphal, what they call White City, you know. And that was the next big place where they had one of the big battles was Imphal and Kohima. And of course, most of the other columns had got there before us and was really having a ding-dong-do, you see. And of course, when we got there, we were... Some of ours was joined in among them, you know, till they finally cleared them out of there, you know.
Is this White City?
Yeah, White City. Mm.
So you personally got to White City, did you?
Yeah, we got to Imphal, yeah. That's what they called White City, was Imphal, you know. And then I think the next place was Kohima. That was the next big battles, was Kohima. Well, most of the infantry was doing the work there, you see, the columns and the mules. We were more or less in the background all the while, not too far away, but we were there, you see. But you had to still sort of still defend yourself if you were anywhere nearby, you know.
Did your column achieve much in the way of disrupting the Japanese?
Not a lot, really. Wingate, Brigadier Ferguson's column, you know, I'm beginning to think that that was a case of seeing how far the Chindis could go on an endurance test. You know what I mean? At the same time, they were using it as a test, because after all, we walked right in from India. So by that time, we were beginning to get a bit fatigued now, you see. We were beginning to... feel a little bit doings. We were getting blokes going down with malaria and all sorts of things, you know. And by the time we were finished that campaign, our mules was getting sore and weary. Our mules were suffering from what they call gall sores, you know, where the saddles was rubbing all the while on them, and the breechings and everything rubbing and causing burn marks, which was making them sore, you see. And of course, as I said, we then shortly started to move back to I don't know whether it was Aberdeen, I think it was Aberdeen, the name of the airstrip where we had to make to get flown out, you know. And that's how we did. I think our last place we more or less had any connection with was Imphal and Kohima, and then we gradually moved away again and made our way back to Aberdeen, which was an airstrip to be flown out to Assam, Camilla in Assam, you know, a big hospital there, because by that time there was a lot of our column was either sent out. They were no good for fighting, they were no good for marching, they were no good for anything. Some of them had to be flown out. I finished up carting about three mules. And by the time I got back to this airstrip, I had about three mules I was leading. The muleteers had gone down sick somewhere along the line. You see, you were missing them all the while, you know. And we got to this airstrip. I remember this is now come to the final phase of our operation. And we got to this airstrip, and of course there was American planes, Dakotas, there was Americans, and there was British pilots all on this airstrip waiting for to fly us out. See, we walked in, so we were flown out, you see. And I remember coming up to this airstrip, and the officers saying to us all, "Well, here you are now," then he says, you're going to be loaded onto these planes and we're going to fly out, back out again now. Well, I suppose there'll be some new batches going in after that, you see, to take over. So we went to an American plane. The officer said, here, load them onto that American plane. Well, the American officers that was flying the plane says, no, blooming likely. He says, I'm not taking no mules on my plane. He said, this Yankee officers on this plane. He says, I'm not having no mules on my plane. He says, kicking the sides out of it. But then poor mules couldn't have kicked nothing, you know. And anyway, British officers stepped forward. They said, come on, lads, we'll take you out. So I got, I got about 9 mules on the plane. Mine, we put 9 on one of these rough planes, you see. Then bamboo poles right down the plane to divide it off. Then the mules was taken into these three sections, 3, 3, and 3, you see, and tethered with just the head rope. So the only thing they could do was just, they couldn't move much in the plane once they got in. They had to stay there, you see. They couldn't move much. And we sat at the front where the cockpit was, meaning I think it was a Scotch lad that was with me. There had to be 2 men to a plane and 6 mules, you see. So the plane hour were on, and there was a Scotch lad with me. My boss sat right near the cockpit where the pilots were. And then, of course, they said, right, we're now going to take off. Just watch your mules. And, if any of them really go mad or anything like that, the officer says we'll just shoot them. You know, but that's how they used to talk, you see. Don't let them get loose and cause havoc. Well, the mules, unfortunately, the 6 we had, and the 9 we had in our plane, was really bad with sores and that they wouldn't have kicked nothing, they just stood there, you know, and the whole plane took off, rattling like a bloomin' every nook and bolt you could hear it rattling. Took off, and away we went. Went to skim these bloomin' mountains, and we took off this airstrip. It was only a short airstrip, so there wasn't much time to get the height, you see. And away we went, and as we were flying along, this would be coming to night time now, and as we were flying along, the officer in the plane come through the little doorway in his cockpit, and he says, would you like to have a last look at the Chinwin before you get back to Camilla? Yeah, we said, well, you know, daft as you like. Yeah, so next thing, boom, down he go. Hell, I thought, hell, these mules now, you know. But they were still as calm as anything. Down he went, and then he swooped back up again. He says, hey, I says, you went a last look at your Chinwin? Well, we never saw the Chinwin. We were too dumb and busy sitting there watching the damp mules. So we got to this air base at Camilla, Bloomin' Great Air Base at Camilla, and Bloomin' Great Hospital it was. So once we landed, the door swung open, there was loads of Indian workmen there, Indian soldiers, and they're more or less just working on the strip, like, you know, airplanes. And our officer said, right, he says to us, don't you touch any of them mules. He says, come on. He says, there's ambulances there waiting for you. Now he says, to these Indian fellas, come on, hurry, hurry, get them mules out, he says. And they're all loading onto mule ambulances and taken to the veterinary hospitals there. So we were taken to the Camilla main hospital. They'd flown a special batch of nurses and sisters out from England to take over this hospital, especially for the Chindits coming in. Well, when we walked into that hospital, the nurses couldn't believe their eyes. We had beards, we were lousy, we had our rifles all cocked with bullets in, you know, and all the beds was there, and we got into this place, into this hospital. Our meals was taken away for treatment at the veterinary hospitals, and we got into the beds of this hospital. We couldn't undress because we had nothing to undress into, you know, no such thing as pajamas. You just lay there with your uniform on. Well, everybody thought, oh, left photographs of ours with our beards on. I had a massive, great, bushy beard. You know, everybody had beards because you weren't allowed to shave. And your hair was matted, and your beards, and everything, you're in a right state. We nearly frightened the damp nurses to death. They were just flown out from this country to take over this hospital for those fellas coming in. But we got in these beds, you know, and put all our rifles down by the side of the bed, all our blooming gear off, and cool. It felt heaven laying on them beds, you know, hospital beds. Well, we laid there all night. They gave us cups of tea and one thing and another, but we didn't have it. They wouldn't give us anything to eat. Next morning, a couple of batch of blooming doctors come sailing through there. Every man, every soldier there was of us, all there. They come through every one of us, and they're testing us and giving us tests and everything, and asking us questions about how we went on in there and what did we suffer with and one thing and another. I was very fortunate. I didn't suffer from much. I did suffer once from the runs and diarrhea, but I think that was the damp water we were drinking, you know, because you'd drink anything there, you know. And anyway, we got fed in this hospital, and you know, for 3 solid weeks, we had nothing but rice puddings, because our stomachs had shrunk that much with these care rations. As a matter of fact, the last week or so of our campaign in Burma, we weren't eating a thing in the care rations. We weren't just eating them. You couldn't, you know. These American care rations, they were, they contained 3 or 4 hard chocolate biscuits. They were all nutritious, these things supposed to be. But by God, you couldn't, you had to have a hammer nearly to break the damn things. You don't have to eat them. And when you were in Burma with these packets, you, with the American care ration packet, you could take your rations out of it, and the packet, you could stand it down and get a match or a lighter, and you could light that packet, and it burned long enough to boil your a Dixie full of water for your break, for your brew. Didn't matter if it was the monsoon and it was sloshing down with rain. The more that rain came on that packet, the better it burned. It's funny, that, wasn't it? Didn't put it out, you just burnt that till you got your Dixie of water boiled. And your, everything was dehydrated, your tea and everything, you had to just, your milk was powdered milk. You made your brew, and then you sat down and ate your little bits and pieces if you could. But we got sick of them rations before we were finished. So we... as I said, you lost some weight. When you come out and you got your beards off, you were like skeletons laying there in them beds, feeding your rice pudding, you know. And that was the last time I saw Burma. I never went back in again, because shortly after that, the Japanese surrendered, didn't they? They dropped them atomic bombs, you know. Well, we were still on our way out when they dropped them. We were still struggling out.
What about discipline in the jungle? Did discipline have to be enforced at any time?
Oh yes, they were very strict, our officers. You couldn't play about or do anything. You were strictly disciplined. You was, you right to the letter. You was absolutely top notch. You couldn't shout or whistle or sing. You couldn't do nothing. If you had to talk, you had to whisper. If I spoke to the lad in front of me, I was, you know, you're whispering, you couldn't talk, because in there, the least little bit of sound carried, you see, and that was one thing that you were taught not to do, was to shout or whistle, because the Japanese picked that up as quick as lightning, you see. So you had to whisper, and that was one reason why the mules was devoiced, so they couldn't talk either, so they couldn't shout or neigh at any other animal.
Did anybody have to be punished on the march?
No, not as far as I know, no. I don't think the lads was glad enough to keep in the column and keep a going, you know what I mean? Because there was times when they got really sick with malaria, you know, and that was dreadful. I remember us carrying a lad, we had a lad, he developed a tumour on the brain when we first started off from India. We got into Burma, and he got a tumour on the brain. Well, this lad was, I think he was in the infantry part, and he kept getting slower and slower as he was walking, till finally he had to drop out, and I remember him, they put him up on a casualty pony just in front of me with my mule. And he was a tallish lad. He come from Workington somewhere, Whitehaven, somewhere there. He was a Cumberland lad. And they put him in this casualty chair because they just stopped him in this chair. Was a thing where it was well stopped on, and the lad was leading the pony, the fella leading the pony. And this lad was just sitting in that chair, and he got to the stage where he was a rambling at night, so it was dreadful in the column when you were laying anywhere near him in the night when you're bivvied. Because when you're bivvied, the medics, the medicals, and funny enough, we had surgeons in the column as well, you know. We had doctors, surgeons, we had veterinary surgeons, we had showies for the mules, you know, showies. We had the men that done all the harnesses, leather waxes, where we called them, you know. We had everything in that column. You carried the whole caboose with you, the army with you, you know, with you on them columns. You had your medical staff, and then you had your doctors, your surgeons, and the surgeons was marching just the same as we were, clambering up the hills just the same. They didn't get no priorities. Everybody was the same, you know. And that's how they went. And that's what the column consisted of. Marvellous, really good organisation, but whether it was any use, well, it must have been, because they really did get the Japanese out of Burma in the long run. So, I mean, they got right to the Indian border, did the Japanese, and they were pushed right back again to where they come from, you see. And there's some fierce battles there. At different places.
What was the food which was dropped to the mules?
We had care rations dropped, and the food that was dropped to the mules was fodder, a bit of hay, and grain. It was what an animal normally eats, a horse, oats, and one thing or another, was dropped. And they come down on top of the packages. We had a supply drop every 5 days, and you were lucky when on this supply drop. There was your mail was dropped from Blighty. There were cigarettes if you smoked. There was all your rations, care rations was dropped. And on the top of the rations was the mule's grain and hay on each package that was dropped. Man, they were big packages, or twice the size of an armchair probably that was coming down, you see. And used to come crashing through them trees. Because we had to pick them up, and we used to make way for a drop. If when we knew there was a drop coming up, we made our way to where the dropping zone was, and we'd mostly be about midnight. We were in the away from the clearing. There was a clearing made for the drop, you see, and then there were some torches lit for the drop. Well, these planes used to fly in, then they used to kick them out. Well, if there was a high wind, they had to allow for the drop. Well, sometimes the drop dropped in the Japanese territory, or vice versa. You see, your drop would drop, and if you weren't careful, it would come crashing through the trees where you were, you know. And then as soon as it was dropped, you had to rush out, take it all back in, take it away off the clearing, get it back into the jungle, and then it was all divided out, and each man put his rations, his 5 days in his back, you see, and everything. And you know, the mule's fodder was strung over its harness, where its neck was, hooked onto its harness, and also on the harness he had hooked on these two water chuggles, what they call chuggles. You remember them? That you filled them with water, and it kept as cool as anything, the water. You filled them with water, and you had to put your chloride tablets in it. And you weren't allowed to drink a drop of that water when you were on the march until you got the order. Now, it's all right, people saying, oh, you can never drink, you know. Didn't matter how thirsty you were, you couldn't drink a drop of that water. And as much as your life was worth if you did. And the mules never got a drink of water until we got to a river. If we were crossing a river, you weren't even allowed to let the mule's head go down, because you know what a mule's like. When you're crossing a river, he's struggling like the devil to get down to that water to get a drink. And you had to try like mad to keep his head to keep his head up from getting his nose into that water. Once he got his nose in, he would never move him. He'd drink and drink till he was bust, you see. So he had to keep going across the river and not letting him drink. And what a job that was. And you then scooped the water because it was as much as your life was worth, because you didn't know what the type of water you were scooping, you know, drinking, you see. If you were crossing anything like that. So you had your water bottle, and you were only allowed to drink when they said so. You had a water bottle full of water on your pack, and you were only allowed to drink that water when you got an order to drink it. You'd carry that water for hours, and then suddenly they'd say, right, two or three mouthfuls of water, and that was it. You see?
What were the mules supposed to drink?
They weren't supposed to drink until you found a proper drinking place. Now, when we got to Bivvy, our officers more or less knew how long that mule could go on his 8 gallons of water it would drink. You see, a mule will drink about 8 gallons at a start when he's drinking. So when we took it to a water hole, what we called a water drinking place, which could be a river, anything, we bivvied, we took all the loads off, and then we had to go with an officer that knew where he was going. He led us to a river. Might be half a mile away, it might be a mile. But we went to that river. And we had an escort when we went, with mules just on the head harness, you know, nothing else on them. When we got to the river, two mules went down at a time to drink. Didn't matter how much your mule struggled to try and get to that water, he had to wait his turn till they went down, then come back up again. Now that mule, when he was down there, he would drink about 7 to 8 gallons of water. And you let him drink that much, you see. You'd tell him nearly when he was finished. Then when he'd finished, you just whipped him around and away he went back again. And then you saw to yourself then. So you couldn't drink just as you wished. So discipline was very, very hard, you know. It was good, and you appreciated that to a certain extent. Because if they didn't have had that discipline, half of the lads, I reckon, would have been in some funny old states other than just getting malaria, you know what I mean?
What about local Burmese? What about the villagers? Did you run into them?
We went through villages. We never bivvied in a village. We always bivvied outside a village. There again, it was probably half a mile away outside a village where you couldn't come in contact with any villagers, you see. The only person that couldn't come in contact with the village before we went through it was our leading officer, might be Major Dickey in our case. He would powwow with the headman of the village and ask him if it was all right to go through, or if there was any Japanese there or whatever. And if the headman said yes, you're quite welcome to come through the village, but you couldn't fraternize, if you know what I mean. Not really to that extent, because he was on in the column and he was moving all the while, so he had to go right through the village, you see. And as you know, a lot of these villages had these here Burmese traitors in them, which you didn't know who they were, so you had to take that chance when you went through a village, whether you were going to get fired on or whether you were going to get through safe. But it all relied on the headman. But what we had in our columns, I forgot to mention that, we had several Burmese intelligence men with us, just like soldiers like us. But the moment we were entering the village, about a mile out, they changed into their Burmese dress, hid the uniform in the gear, in their backs, where we were. We were bivvied outside. The Burmese soldiers would change into the Burmese national dress, and they used to just saunter off into the villages and mix with the villagers, you see, and get all the dope. They just wander about and mix in among the village people, and the village people naturally wouldn't know whether they were their own clan or who they were. They'd just come from another village, you see, and they would just talk the time of day and all the time they're collecting information from the villagers, come back with it, see our intelligence British officers in the column, and then it was all sorted out. Well, we're all right, we can go through there, but there is some Japanese there, And then, of course, if there was, we would circle the village probably, you see, so we got around them without causing any alarm, you know what I mean? But 9 times out of 10, a lot of them villages was clear, you know, of Japanese and traitors, you know, they knew who the traitors were, more or less. And that's how we went. And that's as much as I can more or less tell you of our campaign, briefly.
What do you think would have happened to you if you had been captured by the Japanese?
Well, the motto was that we were told, because it was no good taken prisoner, being taken prisoner in the middle of a jungle by the Japanese, because you wouldn't have survived 5 minutes with them fellas. And we know it's a different matter if you're in a big army and you've got fronts where you're fighting and you know you're fighting, but in there, we were more or less spies. We had no proper front. We were playing hide and seek with one another, in other words, if you know what I mean. You had no proper front. You were just playing hide and seek. Now, our officers said, as much as said to us, because you had no identity on, you're only your one disc with your name and your number on. Other than that, if you had stripes, like I was an NCO at one time, corporal, but I had no insignias on my arm to state that. No officer had his pips on, you see? So everybody was just more or less the same in the Chindits. The Japanese didn't know which was the officer and which wasn't, only for the fact that the officer was at the head of the column. But he wouldn't know exactly who they were, whether they were a colonel, a brigadier, or what they were, you see? But they did say, now, you can expect when you go in there, they used to say to you, the officer, just on a brief talk, they'll probably say, well, now look, don't expect to be taken prisoner in there. And if you have any sense, you'll make sure you don't be taken prisoner. And they didn't mean to you for you to shoot yourself or anything like that. They said, just watch you don't be taken prisoner, because if they take you prisoner, that's your lot. They're not going to cart you to the side of Burma, you know. And that's how it went, you know.